Ms. Nemitz.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Miriam Nemitz, representing Abbott Laboratories. We're here today because Abbott Laboratories decided to hire a new asset technician, and it selected the most qualified candidate for that position. Mr. Patasca was identified as the most qualified candidate because he possessed the industrial mechanical abilities that were important to the position as Abbott had decided to restructure it. Mrs. Tomeo has never been able to prove, she has not even tried to prove, that she possessed similar qualifications. Therefore, she has failed to refute Abbott's explanation for its hiring decision, and Abbott is entitled to judgment as a matter of law on the plaintiff's claim of discrimination. The plaintiff's theory in this case, and this is a theory that appeared in her EEOC charge, she carried it through at trial, and it's carried through her brief. Her theory of the case was that Abbott didn't hire her for her own job. She was a contract worker. She was working as an asset technician.
What did jury instructions say about that question? That is, what did the district judge tell the jury about whether there was any need to hire her for her own job?
He didn't address that. The question was simply put in generally whether, I mean, it was accepted that this was a new position. There was no instruction that she was entitled to any preference in the position. And, in fact, there wasn't any evidence that she was entitled to a preference in the position. There was a selection process. She was a contractor. She had been working as a contractor.
No, mm-hmm. I understand your position. I'm just trying to figure out whether the jury was correctly instructed. Now, I don't read your brief as objecting to any instruction that was either given or omitted, so perhaps there's no such.
There was no specific instruction on that point, Your Honor.
What about the retaliation? What about the retaliation? Who committed the retaliation? Her employer or Abbott Laboratories?
There's no evidence that there was any communication from Abbott to Mrs. Tomeo regarding the expiration of her contract. In fact, there's undisputed evidence that the contract was scheduled to expire on March 29th.
I'm having difficulty figuring out how you retaliate if you're not the employer.
She was, you know, the argument is that Abbott took some action to terminate her position prematurely. That's plaintiff's position. We contend that there was no evidence of an act of retaliation because there was a contract.
How can a non-employer retaliate?
I would agree with you, Your Honor.
I would hope so. But, I mean, that's my question. How can a non-employer retaliate?
In fact, there was a communication that the contract came to an end, and she received a communication from the Mullins agency that her contract had ended, and
Following Judge Easterbrook's question about instructions, did they make a distinction between who she worked for and the fact she was merely a contract employee, not an employee of Abbott?
I believe there was an instruction that said, I mean, for certain purposes, Abbott is the employer. I mean, Abbott was entitled to, I mean, she was supervised by an Abbott employee.
And she was a contractor, but she didn't work for Abbott.
She did not work directly for Abbott. That's clear. There's no dispute about that. Her contention was that that she was not selected to be an Abbott employee for discriminatory reasons.
I understand the failure to hire issue.
Yes. There was ample evidence in the record to show that there were legitimate non-discriminatory reasons for her non-selection. There were, again, it's undisputed, there were three asset technicians who were engaged in
I'm just puzzled by all of this. On the assumption that the jury was correctly instructed, it's almost impossible to get anywhere with this line of argument that we should second-guess the jury's verdict. Right? Maybe there's just nothing here, but the undertone of your brief, indeed the undertone of the plaintiff's brief, was that the plaintiff had litigated this case in the district court on the theory that she was entitled to some preference for her own job and that Abbott wasn't entitled to redefine the job in a way that injured her. And that, one would think, would be worked out in the jury instructions. The jury would be told that Title VII and the other statutes don't impose any such duty. But if there's no dispute about what the jury was told or about whether particular opening and closing arguments were properly presented, It's hard to see how we second-guess the jury's determination about what happened.
Your Honor, we haven't challenged the jury instructions, but our point is that there was a failure of proof. This court looks carefully at the evidence in every employment discrimination case. And if in cases where the plaintiff hasn't really responded, there's hasn't met the evidence, an employer isn't entitled to hire the person who it considers most qualified for the job. In many, many instances, an employer will decide. Abbott was entitled to change these, to decide how it wanted to structure this position and decide what the qualifications were. It's unrefuted, and this is important, Your Honor, it's unrefuted that the job actually changed.
Did the notice for the job have those new qualifications in
The notice did not. This is a bureaucracy. There's such a thing as a job that was an existing job description for the asset technician position. They left it the same. But at the outset, there's evidence that's, again, unrefuted, that Mr. Shorman, who has submitted the job for the he had submitted the job requisition, called Daniel Fletcher, who's Abbott's internal recruiter, and said, "This is what we're looking for. Please find resumes of people who have mechanical abilities."
Well, if she didn't fit any of those qualifications, why was she interviewed?
Excuse me?
If she didn't fit any of the new qualifications, the unpublished ones, why was she interviewed?
She was basically interviewed as a courtesy. I mean, she didn't even submit her resume through this online posting. So a lot of applications.
How was it a courtesy to her to interview her for something for which she had no qualifications?
It was a courtesy because she was in the contract position and people were aware that she wanted to be hired as the new asset technician.
However, Abbott has learned from this experience that interviewing people who you are in the interview going to insult and make it clear that you didn't have a chance to begin with is not a courtesy either to the employee or to Abbott.
There's no doubt that the interview did not advance Abbott's interest in this case, Your Honor. But the important thing about the interview, let me talk about the interview, because the remarks during, she has to show.
You can understand why people get really annoyed if not only you dangle something in front of somebody only to yank it away and say, aha, just fooling, you then say, and you were never any good anyway. Some people might get offended by that.
The remarks during the interview they were in a certain sense unfortunate, but they are not indicative of discrimination. And they certainly don't show, but the important thing here, the ADA and the ADEA don't create a cause of action for people who were insulted in an interview. She has obtained a judgment.
I understand that. That's why I've been asking about whether the instructions to the jury were ever contested.
The instructions to the jury correctly said that she, in order to meet, that she had the burden of proof, and in order to meet her burden of proof, she was obliged to show that if there had been no discrimination and everything else had been the same, she would have been selected for this position. She didn't meet her burden of proof, and this court undertakes in these cases to look to see if there's sufficient evidence to support the verdict. And it has to be, this court has said many times, it has to be substantial evidence.
Unfortunately for you, the plaintiff introduced the job description, which was not consistent with what your story about the real job attributes is. I don't know why, as a matter of law, the jury was disabled from believing Abbott's own job description over Abbott's story about the job description being bureaucracies which we don't pay any attention to. That could be right, but the plaintiff has got the written job description.
Yes, Your Honor, but the proof is in the pudding here, because, in fact, there is testimony about what Mr. Prataska actually did, and he focused on preventative maintenance requests. He didn't do the job that she had done.
That's all fine. The question is whether the plaintiff could use the written job description to say everything else Abbott is telling you is a smokescreen. Well, that's what the kind of thing that sets up a conflict in evidence. That's why one would think, I would have thought, that an appeal in this case would be about what the jury was told about how to deal with the evidence rather than just a raw dispute about the evidence.
Your Honor, the job description doesn't disprove that Mr. Prataska was more This was going to be a job about, he actually works in preventative maintenance. She was, her job was to tag inventory and enter this inventory data into the computer system. His job was different. That's unrefuted. His disinterested witnesses testified that when he joined, he didn't do the work that she had done. The work that she had done was divided up between the other two asset technicians. There were three zones, and then it was unrefuted that after she left, there were two.
Was there some evidence she was scheduled to work even beyond the time you say that her contract extension expired?
Now you're talking about you're addressing a retaliation claim. There are documents that show her on the schedule, but still, going back to the point of her contract. There isn't any evidence that anyone at Abbott. We know that her contract was scheduled to expire on March 29th, and there's no affirmative evidence that anyone at Abbott, you know, ever decided to renew it. The contract
isn't that
typically
scheduling beyond the contract date. Some evidence of that.
When someone's there are things that sort of happen at it. It's a huge company. There are thousands and thousands of employees. So evidence that, I still had my parking pass or that I was listed on some schedule that had been...
Wasn't her security renewed for a six-month period beyond...
But again, that's not done by people who are aware of what's going on with her contract. She's a contract worker. And at the point at which her contract was terminated, her contract expired, that then would go about getting her contract, her parking pass back and... getting her security pass back from her. But the evidence is that the contract was scheduled to expire and would have been renewed the practice had been to submit requests for renewal several weeks earlier. That was not done in this case. I'd like to save some time for rebuttal, Your Honor, so unless you have further questions now.
Certainly, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. As you know, the standard when this court is reviewing a jury verdict is to review the evidence in the light most favorable to the prevailing party, which was the plaintiff. Just to address certain questions that you had asked counsel, there were no objections, and in fact, all of the jury instructions were agreed. Abbott agreed at trial that it was the joint employer of Ms. Tamayo, so that was never an issue.
That's not mentioned in the district court's order about joint employment that I can see.
I believe that there is something in the pretrial transcripts, the trial transcripts during the trial where there was a jury instruction conference held, and it was determined that all of the jury instructions were going to be agreed to. There was one exception, which was what it constitutes a major life activity. The plaintiff proposed that climbing should be included. Defendant objected to that, and the court ruled that climbing should be included. But with respect to every single other jury instruction, they were agreed by the parties.
Well, I get back to my... If there was an agreement they were joint employers, then I can understand the claim of retaliation. If they were not joint employers, I don't understand how you can retaliate.
Well, Abbott actually agreed also pretrial that it was, for purposes of applying the anti-discrimination laws, its employer, Carol Tamayo's employer. And that was stipulated to during the trial. But getting back to the evidence, as our briefs show, there was direct evidence of discriminatory comments and actions during the interview. When you're determining whether or not the employer's decision was motivated by discriminatory actions, you look at what they said and what they did at the time the decision was made. Now, Abbott would have you discount these statements, but it's rare when you actually have a case where you have the plaintiff actually saying, I was told, essentially, I'm too old and I'm too sick to do this job. And then you've got Abbott's own employee, the person who conducted the interview, sit down and write that up and essentially corroborate Ms. Tamayo's allegations. That evidence was presented to the jury, and they accepted that evidence. Abbott offered alternative explanations for those comments. They were not accepted. The evidence here that Ms. Tamayo was not hired for the permanent tech position was not based on this assumption that she was entitled to the job. In fact, there was no instruction and no argument by the plaintiff that she had some entitlement to the job. Rather, the argument was that because she had been doing the job and that the jury did not believe that the job was changing, clearly she was qualified. And that's the argument that Ms. Tamayo made it at trial, and that's the argument that that jury accepted, and that was why they ruled in her favor. With respect to the retaliation claim, Abbott is arguing that the contract simply expired on its own, and they assert that that evidence was unrefuted. On the contrary, there was significant evidence that the contract did not expire on its own. And just to talk to you a little bit about what the evidence of retaliation was, for your honors, I'd like to back up and tell you. So first of all, you have Ms. Tamayo going to the interview. During the interview, she's asked, do you really think you can get out there and climb around anymore? When she responds, yes, I do think I can do that, don't you? The interviewer says, well, we all like to think we could do things we used to do when we were younger. Immediately after...
Weren't those questions about the type of job she performed, not this so-called new job?
Well, that's another fatal flaw in Abbott's argument, that they're trying to explain those questions as simply questions about the job duties at issue. But simultaneously, they're arguing that the job duties were changing entirely and there was going to be no going out there and climbing around anymore. So those explanations they can't be, consolidated or they disagree with their affirmation that the job was changing. So, yes, those questions relate to her old job. Now, if the job was, in fact, changing, there would have been no reason to ask those questions. But immediately after the interview, she complained both to her daughter, who was a manager, also to the person who conducted the interview. And then 3 days later, she complained to the human resources woman who was supposed to accept those complaints. That very same day, she was terminated. Now, Abbott's theory is that she was terminated because the contract was set to expire on its own on March 29th of 2002. But there was substantial evidence.
Do we know whether Abbott told the temp agency anything?
Ms. Mullins, who was the temp agency, took the stand at trial who worked for the temp agency. She testified on direct when being asked by counsel for Abbott that she knew that the contract was set to expire. On cross-examination, she backpedaled from that testimony because she had previously given a sworn declaration that indicated that she had no notice that that contract was supposed to expire, and therefore the jury did and was allowed to reject that testimony. But more importantly than that, nobody at Abbott told...
Not really addressing my question. Do we know from discovery or any direct question of a witness whether somebody at Abbott called somebody at the temp agency and said, time for her to go?
What we know, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question. What we know is that her contract had been extended for 6-month periods during her entire tenure. Then suddenly, with the last extension, Abbott asserts that, no, we only extended it for 3 months. Nobody at Abbott admits having called and said, we don't want to fire her right now, but nobody can explain or nobody also admits having put in the March 29th, 2002 date. So there is no direct evidence one way or the other why it is that suddenly Ms. Tamayo was let go, except that it fell right on the heels of her having complained of retaliation. And I think it's also significant that she was never told that that was her last day. Her supervisor didn't know that that was her last day. In fact, he had asked her to stay on and train the new guy. So certainly there was no knowledge by Ms. Tamayo's supervisor that she was going to be gone. The manager above him, Mr. Shorman, testified that he thought she'd at least stay on till the new guy came on, and he didn't come on until June. So there was a period of several months where there was nobody filling that position. So I think that there is sufficient circumstantial and pretextual evidence in combination with the timing of when she was terminated for the jury to have reached that conclusion that retaliation was the motivation. One of the arguments that counsel hasn't addressed here but is addressed in the briefs is that the retaliation claim should have never gone to the jury in the first instance. The district court heard that argument and rejected it. Essentially, Abbott argued that her retaliation claim was outside of the scope of her EEOC charge. Plaintiffs argued successfully that it was, in fact, within the scope, that it was directly related, it involved the same people, same timing, same events, and that, in fact, the EEOC had actually investigated the retaliation complaint. But more fatal to Abbott's argument is that a failure to exhaust administrative remedies is an affirmative defense. Abbott waived the defense by not raising it at trial. Now, they try to assert that they didn't have to raise it because it's a purely legal issue.
At trial.
Pardon?
Why should it be raised at trial? Exhaustion of administrative remedies may be an affirmative defense, but it's one that's decided by the judge, not the jury.
But when you're looking at an issue of scope of the charge, it is necessarily a legal and a factual issue because the whole doctrine says you look outside the four corners of the charge. If Abbott had raised its affirmative...
The Supreme Court held, I thought, pretty clearly in Federal Express against Holowecki that determining what is or isn't a charge is a question for a judge. It's not going to be sent to the trier of fact. The Supreme Court didn't say in Holowecki, here are our legal standards, now send it to a jury to apply it. The Supreme Court applied it itself. Why isn't that always the case? Have we ever sent this to a jury?
Well, Holowecki is, I think, addressing a little bit different issue, which is that the standard for determining what is a charge under the ADEA has been expanded, which is another sort of refutation of Abbott's argument that it wasn't included the charge. Because under Holowecki now, if a filing is submitted to the EEOC under the ADEA, because it's different than the...
You're not addressing my question.
Yes.
Holowecki said, or proceeded on the view, that this is a question for the judge, not for the jury. And my follow-up question was, have we ever said that exhaustion of administrative remedies or the scope of the charge is a question for a jury?
I am not aware of a particular case that exactly addresses that issue. But all of the cases addressing the scope of the charge do look at factual issues. And if Abbott had presented its affirmative defense or even raised it.
Exactly. You raise the issue before trial. You get sorted out what issues are going to be tried. The judge does that, and then you go ahead and try them.
Right. And that wasn't, and it wasn't raised.
You don't sort out at trial what the scope of the charge was.
And the affirmative defense was never raised, and it was never an instruction for the jury either.
Now, those are two distinct points. The fact that it's not presented to the jury is, I think, irrelevant. What you also said is the affirmative defense was never raised. That is, never raised even before trial. That your position, that it was never raised ever?
It was raised in summary judgment and not raised again at trial.
Well, then the word never is not accurate. It wasn't raised at trial, but it was raised and resolved before trial. So it's properly presented on appeal then.
Correct.
Okay.
But for the reasons already stated, for all of the reasons in the brief, I would ask that this court affirm the jury's verdict, very reasoned verdict, in favor of Ms. Tamayo on both the age claim, on her disability claim, and on the basis that Abbott retaliated against her when she complained of discrimination. Unless there are any further questions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Ms. Brennan. Anything further, Ms. Nowitz?
With respect to the claim of retaliation, the job description that the court has focused on is simply not enough of a basis to conclude that Abbott's explanation for hiring Mr. Potasco was pretextual in light of all the other evidence that, you know, in advance of the hiring, they discussed with others the fact that the internal recruiter was told he should look for someone with mechanical abilities. If you look at Mr. Potaska's resume, he has extensive capabilities that Mrs. Tomeo has conceded she didn't have. And then when he came to work at Abbott, it's undisputed that he employed those capabilities in a complete shift of what the job had been. Mrs. Tomeo cannot make the case. She totally failed to make the case that she would have been a good choice to do that job. And so she has not refuted Abbott's explanation for his hiring decision. And under those circumstances, I mean, there's always some inconsistencies in the evidence, and just the presence of some collateral inconsistencies isn't sufficient to support a verdict of discrimination. With respect to, just briefly, to respond on some of the issues relating to retaliation, Terry Mullins, who testified, never backpedaled. She said that the contract was to expire of its own accord on March 29th. And she said that she was aware of that expiration date. She never took back that testimony. What she said was, I wasn't aware that that was to be the final extension. So when she came back from vacation and found out that the contract had ended, she had not been aware, it wasn't in her mind that that was happening. But it was clear that that was the expiration date. Plus, it was her practice. There was testimony that it was a practice of the agency to communicate with its employees, because they're the agency's employees, when the contract has been terminated, and that it would not be Abbott who would call the employee and say, your contract is over. It would be the contracting agency, and that's exactly what happened here. Somebody from the agency, she went to work for one day after this expiration date occurred, because on the 29th was the last day. She wasn't at work that day. Then the next, it was Monday, the 1st, she had a pre-scheduled absence. So she did come to work on the 2nd, and on that day she received a message from the agency that her contract had terminated, and that's not evidence of retaliation. But as we argued in our briefs, Your Honor, that the retaliation claim should never have gone to the jury, because although the lower court ruled differently.
Let me ask you whether under the standard of Holowecki there was a charge of retaliation.
There was not, Your Honor. Holowecki directs that you look at the charge and the questionnaire, and neither of those articulates a claim of retaliation. I mean,
I understand that what Holowecki says is that there's a charge if something is reasonably construed as a request for the agency to take remedial action.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the plaintiff's brief says that the EEOC understood it that way and, in fact, investigated retaliation.
There isn't evidence that the EEOC investigated retaliation. I mean, there's a distinction between retaliation and discrimination. And she said, she never said, I engaged in protected activity.
I understand that. Mm-hmm. The question I'm asking is plaintiff's brief asserts that the EEOC understood this charge as entailing retaliation and investigated on that premise. Is that true? And if not, why not?
Well, I'll answer that question, and I'd like to tell you why it's not important what they looked at. But the question, there is some evidence that the plaintiff discussed with the EEOC. There are some notes that show the plaintiff discussed with the EEOC investigator the circumstances of her departure from Abbott. Now, those circumstances were relevant to her claim that her departure from Abbott was related to the discrimination. But there's no evidence that they undertook. They didn't interview Mullins. There's no evidence of investigative steps that they took that would constitute an investigation of retaliation. More importantly, Holowecki talks about, you know, whether something's a charge when there isn't really a charge. That's not really what's at issue here. What's at issue here is the scope of what. There was a charge. It's conceded there was a charge. So what's at issue is, what did Abbott have notice of? The purpose of the charge is to give the employer notice on what the claims are against it are. And that.
Thank you very much, counsel. Case is taken under advisement.